ooze was different than the delicate grey-green of new death. Just as sickly, but withal, a colour of life. She took a deep breath, suddenly aware that the window in this room was closed too, and sweat was trickling down the small of her back, seeping unpleasantly into the crack of her buttocks. The sound of the sash rising wakened him. He turned his head on the pillow and smiled faintly when he saw her. "How are you?" She spoke in a hushed voice, as though in a church. Her own voice always seemed too loud, talking to herself. He lifted one shoulder in a slight shrug, but mouthed a silent, "Okay." He looked wilted and damp, the dark hair at his temples sweat-soaked. "It's awfully hot, isn't it?" She waved at the window where warm air, but moving air, came in. He nodded, poking at the collar of his shirt with one bandaged hand. She took the hint and untied it, spreading the slit open as far as it would go to expose his chest to the breeze. His nipples were small and neat, the aureoles pinkish-brown under the dark curly hairs. The sight reminded her of her own milk-full breasts, and she had a moment's insane urge to lift his head, pull down her shift, and put his mouth to her breast. She had an instant's vivid recall of the moment when he had done that, under the willows at River Run, and a warm rush spread through her, tingling from breasts to womb. Blood rising in her cheeks, she turned to look over the nourishment available on the bedside table. There was cold meat broth, spiked with penicillin, in a covered bowl, and a flask of honey-sweetened tea alongside. She took up the spoon and raised a brow inquiringly, her hand hovering over the table. He grimaced slightly, but nodded at the broth. She picked up the cup and sat down on the stool beside him. "Open up the stable door," she said cheerily, circling the spoon toward his mouth as though he were Jem. "Here comes the horsey." He rolled his eyes upward in exasperation. "When I was little," she said, ignoring his scowl, "my parents said things like, 'Here comes the tugboat, open the drawbridge. Open the garage, here comes the car.' But I can't use those with Jem. Did your mother do cars and airplanes?" His lips twisted, but finally settled on a reluctant smile. He shook his head and lifted one hand, pointing toward the ceiling. She turned to see a dark spot on the plaster. Looking closer, she could see that it was a vagrant bee, blundered in from the garden during the day, somnolent now in the shadows. "Yeah. Okay, here comes the honeybee," she said, more softly, slipping the spoon into his mouth. "Bzz, bzz, bzz." She couldn't keep up the attempted air of playfulness, but the atmosphere had relaxed a little. She talked about Jem, who had a new favourite word, wagger, but no one yet had figured out what he meant by it. "I thought maybe it meant cat, but he calls the cat Mau Mau." She brushed a drop of sweat from her forehead with the back of her hand, then dipped the spoon again. "Mrs. Sherston says he should be walking by now," she said, eyes fixed on his mouth. "Her sister's children were both walking at a year old, naturally. I asked Mama, though. She says he's fine. She says kids walk when they're ready, and it can be any time between 10 months and as much as 18, but 15 months is about the usual." She had to watch his mouth in order to guide the spoon, but was aware of his eyes watching her. She wanted to look into them, but was halfway afraid of what she might see in those dark green depths. Would it be the Roger she knew, or the silent stranger, the hanged man? "Oh, I almost forgot." She interrupted herself in the middle of an account of the Wilbers. She hadn't forgotten, but hadn't wanted to blurt the news out right away. "Da spoke to the governor this afternoon. He, the governor, I mean, is giving you a land grant. 5,000 acres. Even as she said it, she realized the absurdity of it. 5,000 acres of wilderness in exchange for a life almost destroyed. Cancel the almost, she thought suddenly, looking at Roger. He frowned at her in what looked like puzzlement, then shook his head and lay back on the pillow, eyes closing. He lifted his hands and let them fall, as though this was simply too much to be asked to contemplate. Maybe it was. She stood watching him in silence, but he didn't open his eyes. There were deep creases where his brows drew together. Moved by the need to touch him, to bridge the barrier of silence, she traced the shadow of the bruise that lay over his cheekbone, her fingers drifting, barely touching his skin. She could see the oddly blurred edges of the bruise, could almost see the dark clotted blood beneath the skin where the capillaries had ruptured. It was beginning to yellow. Her mother had told her that the body's leukocytes would come to the site of an injury, where they gradually broke down the injured cells, thriftily recycling the spilled blood. The changing colours were the result of this cellular housekeeping. His eyes opened, fixed on her face, his own expression impassive. She knew she looked worried and tried to smile. "You don't look dead," she said. That broke the impassive facade. His eyebrows twitched upward, and a faint gleam of humour came into his eyes. "Roger." At a loss for words, she moved impulsively toward him. He stiffened slightly, hunching instinctively to protect the fragile tube in his throat. But she put her arms around his shoulders, careful, but needing desperately to feel the substance of his flesh. "I love you," she whispered, and her hand tightened on the muscle of his arm, urging him to believe it. She kissed him. His lips were warm and dry, familiar. And yet a feeling of shock ran through her. No air moved against her cheek, no warm breath touched her from his nose or mouth. It was like kissing a mask. Air, damp from the secret depths of his lungs, hissed cool from the amber tube against her neck, like the exhalation from a cave. Goose flesh ran down her arms, and she stepped back, hoping that neither shock nor revulsion showed on her face. His eyes were closed, squeezed tight shut. The muscle of his jaw bulged. She saw the shift of the shadow there. "You rest," she managed, her voice shaky. I'll see you in the morning." She made her way downstairs, barely noticing that the candlestick in the hall was lit now, or that the waiting slave slid silently from the shadows back into the room. Her hunger had come back, but she didn't go downstairs in search of food. She had to do something about the unused milk first. She turned toward her parents' room, feeling a faint draught move through the stifling shadows. In spite of the warm, muggy air, her fingers felt cold, as though turpentine was still evaporating from her skin.
This ends Disc 31. The Fiery Cross, Disc 32.
"Last night I dreamed about my friend Deborah. She used to make money doing tarot readings in the student union. She'd always offer to do one for me for free, but I wouldn't let her. Sister Marie Romaine told us in the fifth grade that Catholics aren't allowed to do divination. We weren't to touch Ouija boards or tarot cards or crystal balls, because things like that are seductions of the D-E-V-I-L. She always spelled it out like that. She'd never say the word. I'm not sure where the devil came into it, but somehow I couldn't bring myself to let Deb do readings for me. She was, last night, though, in my dream. I used to watch her do it for other people. The tarot cards fascinated me, maybe just because they seemed forbidden. But the names were so cool. The Major Arcana, the Minor Arcana, Knight of Pentacles, Page of Cups, Queen of Wands, King of Swords, the Empress, the Magician, and the Hanged Man. Well, what else would I dream about? I mean, this wasn't a subtle dream, no doubt about it. There it was, right in the middle of the spread of cards, and Deb was telling me about it. A man is suspended by one foot from a pole laid across two trees. His arms, folded behind his back, together with his head, form a triangle with the point downward. His legs form a cross. To an extent, the hanged man is still earthbound, for his foot is attached to the pole. I could see the man on the card, suspended permanently halfway between heaven and earth. That card always looked odd to me. The man didn't seem to be at all concerned, in spite of being upside down and blindfolded. Deb kept scooping up the cards and laying them out again, and that one kept coming up in every spread. "The hanged man represents the necessary process of surrender and sacrifice," she said. "This card has profound significance," she said, and she looked at me and tapped her finger on it. "But much of it is veiled. You have to figure out the meaning for yourself. Self-surrender leads to transformation of the personality, but the person has to accomplish his own regeneration." Transformation of the personality. That's what I'm afraid of, all right. I like Roger's personality just fine the way it was. Well, rats. I don't know how much the D-E-V-I-L has to do with it, but I'm sure that trying to look too far into the future is a mistake. At least right now. Chapter 74. The Sounds of Silence. It was 10 days before Penelope Sherston's portrait was completed to her satisfaction. By that point, both Isaiah Morton and Roger had recovered sufficiently for travel. Given the imminence of Morton's offspring and the danger to him in coming anywhere near either Granite Falls or Brownsville, Jamie had arranged for him and Alicia to lodge with the brewmaster of Mr. Sherston's brewery. Isaiah would undertake employment as a wagoner for the brewery as soon as his strength permitted. "I can't imagine why," Jamie had said to me privately, "but I've grown a bit fond of the immoral wee loon. I shouldn't have liked to see him murdered in cold blood." Isaiah's spirits had revived spectacularly upon the arrival of Alicia, and within a week he'd made his way downstairs to sit watching Alicia like a devoted dog as she worked in the kitchen, and to pause on his way back to bed to offer comments on the progress of Mrs. Sherston's portrait. "Don't it look just like her?" he'd said admiringly, standing in his nightshirt in the door of the drawing-room where the sitting was in progress. "Why, if you was to see that picture, you'd know just who it was." Given the fact that Mrs. Sherston had chosen to be painted as Salome, I wasn't positive that this would be considered a compliment, but she flushed prettily and thanked him, evidently recognising the sincerity in his tone. Bree had done a marvellous job, contriving to portray Mrs. Sherston both realistically and flatteringly, but without overt irony, difficult as that must have been. The only point where she had given in to temptation was in a minor detail. The severed head of John the Baptist bore a striking resemblance to Governor Tryon's saturnine features, but I doubted that anyone would notice, what with all the blood. We were ready to go home, and the house was filled with a spirit of restless excitement and relief. Except for Roger. Roger was indisputably better in purely physical terms. His hands were mobile again, bar the broken fingers, and most of the bruising over his face and body had faded. Best of all, the swelling in his throat had subsided enough that he could move air through his nose and mouth again. I was able to remove the tube from his throat and stitch up the incision, a small but painful operation that he had borne with body stiff and eyes wide open, staring up at the ceiling while I worked. In mental terms, I wasn't so sure of his recovery. After stitching his throat, I'd helped him sit up, wiped his face, and given him a little water mixed with brandy as a restorative. I'd watched carefully as he swallowed, then put my fingers lightly on his throat, felt carefully, and asked him to swallow again. I closed my eyes, feeling the movement of his larynx, the rings of his trachea as he swallowed, assessing as best I could the degree of damage. At last I opened my eyes to find his eyes 2 inches from my own and still wide open, the question in them cold and stark as glacier ice. "I don't know," I said at last, my own voice no more than a whisper. My fingers still rested on his throat. I could feel the thrum of blood through the carotid under my palm, his life flowing just below the skin. but the angular hardness of his larynx lay still under my fingers, queerly misshapen. I felt no pulsing there, no vibration of air across the vocal cords. "I don't know," I said again, and drew my fingers slowly away. "Do you want to try now?" He had shaken his head then, and risen from the bed, going to the window, facing away from me. His arms were braced against the frame as he looked down into the street, and a faint, uneasy memory stirred in my mind. It had been a moonlit night then, not broad day, in Paris. I had waked from sleep to see Jamie standing naked in the window frame, the scars on his back pale silver, arms braced and body gleaming with cold sweat. Roger was sweating too from the heat. The linen of his shirt stuck to his body, and the lines of his body were just the same. The look of a man braced to meet fear, one who chose to face his demons alone. I could hear voices in the street below. Jamie coming back from the camp, with Jemmy held before him on his saddle. He had formed the habit of taking Jem with him on his daily errands, so that Bree could work without distraction. In consequence, Jemmy had learned 4 new words, only 2 of them obscene, and Jamie's good coat sported jam stains and smelled like a soiled diaper, but both of them seemed generally pleased with the arrangement. Bree's voice floated up from below, laughing as she went out to retrieve her son. Roger stood as though he'd been carved out of wood. He couldn't call to them, but he might have knocked on the window frame or made some other noise, waved to them. But he didn't move. After a moment, I rose quietly and left the room, feeling a lump in my throat, hard and unswallowable. When Bree had carried Jemmy off for his bath, Jamie told me that Tryon had released most of the men captured during the battle.
Hugh Fowles among them.
He put aside his coat and loosened the collar of his shirt, raising his face to the slight breeze from the window.
I spoke for him, and Tryon listened. As well he might, I said, with an edge to my voice.
He glanced at me and made a noise deep in his throat. It reminded me of Roger, whose larynx was no longer capable of that peculiarly Scottish form of expression. I must have looked distressed at the thought, for Jamie raised his brows and touched my arm. It was too hot to embrace, but I pressed my cheek against his shoulder briefly, taking comfort from the solidness of his body under the thin, damp linen. "I sewed up Roger's throat," I said. "He can breathe. But I don't know whether he'll ever be able to talk again, let alone sing." The unvoiced thought floated in the muggy air. Jamie made another noise, this one deep and angry.
"I spoke to Tryon regarding his promise to Roger Mack as well. He's given me the document of the land grant, 5,000 acres, adjoining my own. His last official act as governor. Almost."
"What do you mean by that?"
"I said he'd released most of the prisoners."
He moved away, restless.
"All but 12. He has a dozen men still jailed, outlawed ringleaders of the regulation, or so he says."
The irony in his voice was as thick as the dusty air.
"He'll hold them for trial in a month, on charges of rebellion."
"And if they're found guilty?"
"At least they'll be able to speak before they hang."
He had stopped in front of the portrait, frowning, though I wasn't sure whether he was actually seeing it or not.
"I will not stay to see it. I told Tryon that we must go to tend our crops and farms. He has released the militia company from service on those grounds."
I felt a lightening of the weight on my heart. It would be cool in the mountains, the air green and fresh. It was a good place to heal. "When will we go?"
"Tomorrow."
He had noticed the portrait. He nodded at the gape-jawed head on the platter in grim approval.
"There's only the one thing to stay for, and I think there's little point to it now."
"What's that?"
"Dougal's son," he said. turning away from the portrait. "I've been seeking William Buckley Mackenzie from one end of the county to the other for the past 10 days. I found some who kent him, but none who's seen him since Alamance. Some said perhaps he'd left the colony altogether. A good many of the regulators have fled. Husband's gone, taken his family to Maryland, they say. But as for William Mackenzie, the man's disappeared like a snake down a rat hole. Him and his family with him. Last night I dreamed we were lying under a big rowan tree, Roger and I. It was a beautiful summer day and we were having one of those conversations we used to have all the time. About things we missed. Only the things we were talking about were there on the grass between us. I said I'd sell my soul for a Hershey bar with almonds, and there it was. I slipped the outer wrapper off, and I could smell the chocolate. I unfolded the white paper wrapper inside and started eating the chocolate. But it was the paper we were talking about then. The wrapper. Roger picked it up and said what he missed most was loo paper. This was too slick to wipe your ass with. I laughed and said there wasn't anything complicated about toilet paper. People could make it now if they wanted to. There was a roll of toilet paper on the ground. I pointed at it, and a big bumblebee flew down and grabbed the end of it and flew off, unfurling the toilet paper in its wake. It flew in and out, weaving it through the branches overhead. Then Roger said it was blasphemy to think about wiping yourself with paper. It is here. Mama writes in tiny letters when she does her case notes, and when Dar writes to Scotland, he writes on both sides of the page, and then he turns it sideways and writes across the lines, so it looks like lattice work. And I could see Dar sitting on the ground writing a letter to Aunt Jenny on the toilet paper, and it was getting longer and longer, and the bee was carrying it up into the air, flying off towards Scotland with it. I use more paper than anyone. Aunt Jocasta gave me some of her old sketchbooks to use, and a whole choir of watercolour paper. But I feel guilty when I use them, because I know how expensive it is. I have to draw, though. The nice thing about doing this portrait for Mrs. Sherston, since I'm earning money, I feel I can use a little paper. Then the dream changed, and I was drawing pictures of Jemmy with a number 2B yellow pencil. It said Ticonderoga on it in black letters, like the ones we used to use in school. I was drawing on toilet paper, though, and the pencil kept ripping through it, and I was so frustrated that I wadded up a bunch in my hand. Then it went into one of those boring, uncomfortable dreams where you're wandering around looking for a place to go to the bathroom and can't find one, and finally you wake up enough to realize that you do have to go to the bathroom. I can't decide whether I'd rather have the Hershey bar, the toilet paper, or the pencil. I think the pencil. I could smell the freshly sharpened wood on the point and feel it between my fingers and my teeth. I used to chew my pencils when I was little. I still remember what it felt like to bite down hard and feel the paint and wood give just a little, and munch my way up and down the length of the pencil until it looked like a beaver had been gnawing on it. I was thinking about that this afternoon. It made me feel sad that Jem won't have a new yellow pencil or a lunchbox with Batman on it when he goes to school, if he ever does go to school. Roger's hands are still too bad to hold a pen. And now I know that I don't want pencils or chocolate or even toilet paper. I want Roger to talk to me again. Chapter 75. Speak My Name. Our journey back to Fraser's Ridge was much quicker than the one to Alamance, for all that the return was uphill. It was late May, and the cornstalks stood already high and green in the fields around Hillsborough, shedding golden pollen on the wind. The grain would be just up in the mountains, and the newborn stock appearing, calves and foals and lambs needing protection from wolf and fox and bear. The militia company had disbanded at once upon receiving the governor's dismissal, its members scattering in haste to return to their homesteads and fields. We were, in consequence, a much smaller party going back. Only two wagons. A few of the men who lived near the ridge had chosen to travel with us, as had the two Findlay boys, since we would pass by their mother's homestead on our way. I cast a covert glance at the Findlays, who were helping to unload the wagon and set up our nightly camp. Nice boys, though quiet. They were respectful of, and rather awed by, Jamie, but had developed a peculiar sense of allegiance to Roger over the course of the short-lived campaign, and this odd fidelity had continued even after the militia's disbanding. They had come, the two of them, to see him in Hillsborough, wriggling their bare toes in embarrassment on Phoebe Sherston's Turkish carpets. Scarlet-faced and nearly speechless themselves, they had presented Roger with three early apples, lopsided green nubbins, obviously stolen from someone's orchard on the way. He had smiled broadly at them in thanks, picked up one of the apples, and taken a heroic bite from it before I could stop him. He hadn't swallowed anything but soup for a week and nearly choked to death. Still, he got it down, strangling and gasping, and all three of them had sat there grinning wordlessly at each other, tears standing in their eyes. The Findlays were usually to be found somewhere near Roger as we travelled, always watchful, leaping to help with anything he couldn't quite manage with his injured hands. Jamie had told me about their uncle, Ian Moore. Plainly they had a good deal of experience in anticipating unspoken needs. Young and strong, Roger had healed quickly, and the fractures weren't bad ones. But 2 weeks wasn't a long time for broken bones to knit. I would have preferred to keep him bandaged for another week, but he was all too plainly chafing at the restraint. I had reluctantly taken the splints off his fingers the day before, warning him to take things easy. "Don't you dare!" I said now, seizing his arm as he reached into the wagon for one of the heavy rucksacks of supplies. He looked down at me, one eyebrow raised, then shrugged good-naturedly, and stood back, letting Hugh Findlay pull out the sack and carry it away. Roger pointed at the ring of firestones Ian Findlay was assembling, then at the woods nearby. Could he gather firewood? "Certainly not," I said firmly. He pantomimed drinking and raised his brows. "Fetch water." "No," I said. "All it needs is for a bucket to slip and..." I looked around, trying to think of something he could safely do, but all camp-making chores involved rough work. At the same time, I knew how galling he found it to stand by, feeling useless. He was bloody tired of being treated like an invalid, and I could see the gleam of incipient rebellion in his eye. One more no, and he would probably try to pick up the wagon, just to spite me.
"Can he write, Sassenach?"
Jamie had paused by the wagon and noticed the impasse in progress. "Write? Write what?" I asked in surprise. But he was already reaching past me, digging out the battered portable writing desk he carried when travelling.
"Love letters," Jamie suggested, grinning down at me. "Or sonnets, maybe."
He tossed the lap desk to Roger, who caught it neatly in his arms, even as I yelped in protest.
"But perhaps before you compose an epic in William Tryon's honour, Roger Mac, you might oblige me with the tale of how our mutual kinsman came to try and murder you, eh?"
Roger stood stock still for a moment, clutching the desk, but then gave Jamie a lopsided smile and nodded slowly. He had begun while the camp was set up, paused to eat supper, and then taken up the task again. It was tiresome work and very slow. The fractures were mostly healed, but his hands were very stiff, sore, and awkward. He had dropped the quill a dozen times. It made my own finger joints ache just to watch him.
"Ow, will you stop that?"
I looked up from scouring out a pan with a handful of rushes and sand, to find Brianna locked in mortal combat with her son, who was arched backward like a bow over her arm, kicking, squirming, and making the sort of nerve-racking fuss that makes even devoted parents momentarily contemplate infanticide. I saw Roger's shoulders draw up toward his ears at the racket, but he went doggedly on with his writing.
"What is the matter with you?" Bree demanded crossly. She knelt and wrestled Jemmy into a semi-sitting position, evidently trying to make him lie down so she could change his clout for the night. The diaper in question was much in need of attention, being wet, grimy, and hanging halfway down the little boy's legs. Jem, having slept most of the afternoon in the wagon, had wakened, sun-dazed, cranky, and in no mood to be trifled with, let alone changed and put to bed. "Perhaps he isn't tired yet," I suggested. "He's eaten, though, hasn't he?" This was a rhetorical question. Jemmy's face was smeared with hasty pudding, and he had bits of eggy toast in his hair. "Yes." Bree ran a hand through her own hair, which was cleaner, but no less dishevelled. Jem wasn't the only cranky one in the Mackenzie family. "Maybe he's not tired, but I am." She was. She had walked beside the wagon most of the day to spare the horses on the steepening slopes. So had I. "Leave him here and go and have a wash, why don't you?" I said, nobly suppressing a yawn. I picked up a large wooden spoon and waggled it alluringly toward Jem, who was oscillating backward and forward on his hands and knees, emitting horrible whining noises. Spotting the spoon, he stopped making the noise, but crouched in place, glaring suspiciously. I added an empty tin cup to the lure, setting it on the ground near him. That was enough. He rolled onto his bottom with a squish, picked up the spoon with both hands, and began trying to pound the cup into the dirt with it. Bree cast me a look of profound gratitude, scrambled to her feet, and disappeared into the woods leading down the slope to the small creek. A quick rinse in cold water, surrounded by dark forest, wasn't quite the sybaritic escape that a fragrant bubble bath by candlelight might be, but escape was the important word here. A little solitude worked wonders for a mother, as I knew from experience. And if cleanliness wasn't quite next to godliness, having clean feet, face, and hands definitely improved one's outlook on the universe, particularly after a day of sweat, grime, and dirty diapers. I examined my own hands critically. Between horse leading, fire starting, cooking, and pot scouring, my own outlook on the universe could stand a bit of improvement too. Still, water wasn't the only liquid capable of lifting one's spirits. Jamie reached over my shoulder, put a cup of something into my hands, and sat down beside me, his own cup in hand. "Slanja, Munyandun," he said softly, smiling at me as he lifted his cup in salute. "Mmm." I closed my eyes, inhaling the fragrant fumes. "Is it proper to say slanja if it isn't whiskey you're drinking?" The liquid in the cup was wine, and a nice one too. Rough, but with a good round flavour, redolent of sun and grape leaves.
"I can't see why not," Jamie said logically. "It's only to wish you good health, after all."
"True, but I think good health may be more a practical wish than a figurative one, at least with some whiskies, that you hope the person you're toasting survives the experience of drinking it, I mean."
He laughed, eyes creasing in amusement.
"I haven't killed anyone with my distilling yet, Sassenach." "I didn't mean yours," I assured him, pausing for another sip. "Oh, that's nice."
I was thinking of those three militiamen from Colonel Ash's regiment. The three in question had been found blind drunk. In one case, literally blind, by a sentry after having indulged in a bottle of so-called whiskey obtained from God knew where. As Ash's company had no surgeon, and we were camped next to them, I'd been summoned in the middle of the night to deal with the matter as best I could. All three men had survived, but one had lost the sight in one eye, and another, plainly, had minor brain damage. Though, privately, I had my doubts as to how intelligent he could have been to start with. Jamie shrugged. Drunkenness was a simple fact of life, and bad brewing was another.
"A thicker show, Mahushla," he called, seeing Jemmy, who had lost interest in spoon and cup, making off on hands and knees toward the coffee pot which had been left to keep hot between the stones of the fire ring.
Jemmy ignored the summons, but was snatched away from danger by Tom Findlay, who snagged him neatly round the waist and delivered him, kicking, to Jamie.
"Sit," Jamie said firmly to him,
and without waiting for a response, parked the child on the ground and handed him his ball of rags. Jemmy clutched this, looking craftily from his grandfather to the fire.
"Throw that in the fire, Ahushla, and I'll smack your bum,"
Jamie informed him pleasantly. Jemmy's brow contorted and his lower lip protruded, quivering dramatically. He didn't throw the ball into the fire, though.
"Ahushla," I said, trying out the pronunciation. "That's a new one. What's it mean?"
"Ooh."
Jamie rubbed a finger across the bridge of his nose, considering.
"It means my blood."
"I thought that was mool."
"Aye, it is. But that's blood like what comes out when you wound yourself. Ahushla is more like, 'O thou in whose veins runs my very blood.' You only say it to a wee bairn, mostly. One you're related to, of course."
"That's lovely."
I set my empty wine cup on the ground and leaned against Jamie's shoulder. I still felt tired, but the magic of the wine had smoothed the rough edges of exhaustion, leaving me pleasantly muzzy.
"Would you call Jermaine that, do you think? Or Joan? Or is it meant very literally, Ahushla?"
"I should be more inclined to call Jermaine un petit émadeur," he said, with a faint snort of amusement. "But Joan, I would call wee Joanie Ahushla. It's blood of the heart, Ken, not only the body."
Jemmy had let his rag ball fall to the ground and was staring in open-mouthed enchantment at the fireflies which had begun to blink in the grass as darkness fell. With our stomachs full and cool rest at hand, everyone was beginning to feel the soothing effects of the gathering night. The men were sprawled in the grassy dark under a sycamore tree, passing the wine bottle from hand to hand, and exchanging talk in the easy, half-connected fashion of men who know each other well. The Findlay boys were on the wagon track, that being the only really clear space, throwing something back and forth, missing half their catches as darkness fell, and exchanging genial shouted insults. There was a loud rustling of bushes beyond the fire, and Brianna emerged, looking damp but much more cheerful. She paused by Roger, a light hand on his back, and looked over his shoulder at what he was writing. He glanced up at her, then, with a shrug of resignation, withdrew the finished pages of his opus and handed them to her. She knelt down beside him and began to read, brushing back wet strands of hair and frowning to make out the letters by firelight. A firefly landed on Jamie's shirt, glowing cool green in the shadowed folds of cloth. I moved a finger toward it, and it flew away, spiralling above the fire like a runaway spark. "It was a very good idea making Roger write," I said, looking across the fire with approval. "I can't wait to find out what actually happened to him."
"Nor I," Jamie agreed. "Though we William Buckley vanished, what's happened to Roger Mack is maybe no so important as what will happen to him."
I didn't have to ask what he meant by that. More than anyone, he knew what it meant to have a life kicked out from under one, and what strength was required to rebuild it. I reached for his right hand, and he let me take it. Under cover of darkness, I stroked his crippled fingers, tracing the thickened ridges of the scars.
"So it doesn't matter to you to find out whether your cousin is a cold-blooded murderer or not?" I asked lightly, to cover the more serious conversation going on silently between our hands.
He made a small, gruff sound that might have been a laugh. His fingers curled over mine, smooth with callous, pressing in acknowledgement.
"He's a Mackenzie, Sassenach. A Mackenzie of Leoch."
The phasers were stubborn as rocks, I'd been told, and Jamie himself had described the Mackenzies of Leoch, charming as larks in the field and as sly as foxes with it. That had certainly been true of his uncles, Colum and Dougal. I hadn't heard anything to indicate that his mother, Ellen, had shared that particular family characteristic, but then Jamie had been only 8 when she died. His aunt Jocasta?
No one's fool, certainly,
but with a good deal less scope for plotting and scheming than her brothers had had, I thought.
You what?
Brianna's exclamation drew my attention back to the other side of the fire. She was looking at Roger, the pages in her hand, an expression of mingled amusement and dismay on her face. I couldn't see Roger's face. He was turned toward her. One hand rose in a shushing gesture, though, and he turned his head toward the tree where the men sat drinking to be sure no one had heard her exclamation. I caught a glimpse of firelight shining on the bones of his face, and then his expression changed in an instant from wariness to horror. He lunged to his feet, mouth open.
"Stop!"
he roared. It was a terrible cry, loud and harsh, but with a ghastly strangled quality to it, like a shout forced out around a fist shoved down his throat. It froze everyone in earshot, including Jemmy, who had abandoned the fireflies and stealthily returned to an investigation of the coffee pot. He stared up at his father, his hand 6 inches from the hot metal. Then his face crumpled, and he began to wail in fright. Roger reached across the fire and snatched him up. The little boy screamed, kicking and squirming, to get away from this terrifying stranger. Bree hastily took him, clutching him to her bosom and burying his face in her shoulder. Her own face had gone pale with shock. Roger looked shocked, too. He put a hand to his throat, gingerly, as though unsure he was really touching his own flesh. The ridge of the rope scar was still dark under his jaw. I could see it, even in the flicker of the firelight, along with the smaller, neater line of my own incision. The initial shock of his shout had worn off, and the men came scrambling out from under the tree, the Findleys rushing in from the road to gather round Roger, exclaiming in astonishment and congratulation. Roger nodded, submitted to having his hand shaken and his back pounded, all the while looking as though he would strongly prefer to be elsewhere.
"See something else?" Hugh Findlay coaxed him.
"Yes, sir, you can do it," Ian joined in, round face beaming. See, she sells seashells by the seashore."
This suggestion was howled down to be replaced by a rain of other excited proposals. Roger was beginning to look rather desperate, his jaw set tight. Jamie and I had got to our feet. I could feel Jamie setting himself to intervene in some way. Then Brianna pushed her way through the excited throng, with Jemmy perched on one hip, regarding the proceedings with intense distrust. She took Roger's hand with her free one and smiled at him, the smile trembling only a little round the edges.
"Can you say my name?" she asked.
Roger's smile matched hers. I could hear the air rasp in his throat as he took a breath. This time he spoke softly, very softly, but everyone held silence, leaning forward to listen. It was a ragged whisper, thick and painful, the first syllable punched hard to force it through his scarred vocal cords, the last of it barely audible. "But..."
"Brianna,"
he said. And she burst into tears. Chapter 76. Blood Money. Fraser's Ridge, June 1771. I sat in the visitor's chair in Jamie's study, companionably grating blood roots while he wrestled with the quarterly accounts. Both were slow and tedious businesses, but we could share the light of a single candle and enjoy each other's company. And I found enjoyable distraction in listening to the highly inventive remarks he addressed to the paper under his quill.
"Egg-sucking son of a porcupine," he muttered. "Look at this, Sassenach, the man's nae more than a common thief. 2 shillings 3 pence for 2 loaves of sugar and a brick of indigo."
I clicked my tongue sympathetically, forbearing to note that 2 shillings seemed a modest enough price for substances produced in the West Indies, transported by ship to Charleston, and thence carried by wagon, pirogue, horseback and foot another several 100 miles overland, to be finally brought to our door by an itinerant peddler who didn't expect payment for the 3 or 4 months until his next visit, and who would in any case likely not get cash, but rather 6 pots of gooseberry jam or a haunch of smoked venison.
"Look at that,"
Jamie said rhetorically, scratching his way down a column of figures and arriving with a vicious stab at the bottom.
"A cask of brandy wine at 12 shillings, 2 bolts of muslin at 3 and 10 each, ironmongery. What in the name of buggery is wee Roger wanting wee an ironmonger? Has he thought of a way to play tunes on a hoe? Ironmongery, 10 and 6.
"I believe that was a ploughshare," I said pacifically. "It's not ours. Roger bought it for Geordie Chisholm." Ploughshares were, in fact, rather expensive. Having to be imported from England, they were rare among colonial small farmers, many of whom made do with nothing more than wooden dibbles and spades, with an axe and perhaps an iron hoe for ground clearing. Jamie squinted balefully at his figures, rumpling a hand through his hair.
"Aye," he said, "only Geordie hasn't got a spare penny to bless himself with, not until next year's crops are sold. So it's me that's paying the 10 and 6 now, isn't it?"
Without waiting for an answer, he plunged back into his calculations, muttering,
"Dirt-eating son of a flying tortoise," under his breath,
with no indication whether this applied to Roger, Geordie, or the ploughshare. I finished grating a root and dropped the stub into a jar on the desk. Bloodroot is aptly named. The scientific name is sanguinaria, and the juice is red, acrid, and sticky. The bowl in my lap was full of oozy, moist shavings, and my hands looked as though I had been disemboweling small animals. "I have 6 dozen bottles of cherry cordial made," I offered, picking up another root.
As though he didn't know that. The whole house had smelled like cough syrup for a week.
"Fergus can take those over to Salem and sell them." Jamie nodded absently.
"Aye, I'm counting on that to buy seed corn. Have we anything else that can go to Salem? Candles? Honey?"
I gave him a sharp glance, but encountered only the whorled cowlicks on top of his head, bent studiously over his figures. The candles and honey were a sensitive subject.
"I think I can spare 10 gallons of honey," I said guardedly.
"Perhaps 10... well, all right, 12 dozen candles." He scratched the tip of his nose with the end of the quill, leaving a blot of ink.
"I thought you'd had a good year with the hives," he said mildly.
I had. My original single hive had expanded, and I now had 9 bee gums bordering my garden. I had taken nearly 50 gallons of honey from them, and enough beeswax for a good 30 dozen candles. On the other hand, I had uses in mind for those things. "I need some of the honey for the surgery," I said. "It makes a good antibacterial dressing over wounds."
One eyebrow went up, though he kept his eyes on the hen scratches he was making. "I should think it would draw flies," he said, "if not bears."
He flicked the end of his quill, dismissing the thought.
"How much do you need, then? I shouldn't have think you've so many wounded coming through your surgery as to require 40 gallons of honey, unless you're plastering them with it head to toe."
I laughed, despite my wariness. "No, 2 or 3 gallons should be enough for dressings. Say 5, allowing extra to make up electrolytic fluids." He glanced up at me, both brows raised.
"Electric?"
He looked at the candle, its flame wavering in the draught from the window, then back at me.
"Did Brianna not say that was something to do with lights? Or lightning, at least?"
"No, electrolyte," I amplified. "Sugar water. You know, when a person is feeling shocked or is too ill to eat, or has the flux, an electrolytic fluid is one that supports the body by putting back the essential ions they've lost from bleeding or diarrhea. The bits of salt and sugar and other things, which in turn draws water into the blood and restores blood pressure. You've seen me use it before."
"Ooh, is that how it works?"
His face lighted with interest, and he seemed about to ask for an explanation. Then he caught sight of the stack of receipts and correspondence still waiting on his desk, sighed, and picked up his quill again.
"Very well, then," he conceded. "Keep the honey. Can I sell the soap?"
I nodded, pleased. I had, with a good deal of cautious experimentation,
succeeded at last in producing a soap that didn't smell like a dead pig soaked in lye, and that didn't remove the upper layer of the epidermis. It required sunflower oil or olive oil in lieu of suet, though, both very expensive. I had it in mind to trade my spare honey to the Cherokee ladies for sunflower oil with which to make both more soap and shampoo. Those, in turn, would fetch excellent prices almost anywhere. Cross Creek, Wilmington, New Bern, even Charleston, should we ever venture that far. Or so I thought. I was unsure whether Jamie would agree to gamble on that enterprise, though. It would take months to come to fruition, while he could dispose of the honey at an immediate profit. If he saw for sure that the soap would bring much more than the raw honey, though, there would be no difficulty in getting my way. Before I could expound on the prospects, we heard the sound of light footsteps in the hall and a soft rap at the door.
"Come," Jamie called, pulling himself up straight.
Mr. Weems poked his head into the room, but hesitated, looking mildly alarmed at the sight of the sanguinary splotches on my hands. Jamie beckoned him companionably in with a flick of his quill.
"Aye, Joseph."
"If I might speak a word in your ear, sir."
Mr. Weems was dressed casually in shirts and breeks, but had slicked down his fine pale hair with water, indicating some formality about the situation. I pushed back my chair, reaching to gather up my leavings, but Mr. Weems stopped me with a brief gesture.
"Oh, no, ma'am. If you wouldn't mind, I should like you to stay. It's about Lizzie, and I should value a woman's opinion on the matter."
"Of course." I sat back, brows raised in curiosity.
"Lizzie? Have you found out wee lass a husband then, Joseph?"
Jamie dropped his quill into the jar on his desk and sat forward, interested, gesturing toward an empty stool. Mr. Weems nodded, the candlelight throwing the bones of his thin face into prominence. He took the proffered seat with a certain air of dignity, quite at odds with his usual attitude of mild discombobulation.
"I am thinking so, Mr. Fraser. Robin McGilvery came to call upon me this morning to spear for my Elizabeth, to be pledged to his lad, Manfred."
My eyebrows went a little higher. To the best of my knowledge, Manfred McGilvery had seen Lizzie less than half a dozen times and hadn't spoken more than the briefest of courtesies to her. It wasn't impossible that he should have been attracted. Lizzie had grown into a delicately pretty girl, and if still very shy, was possessed of nice manners. It scarcely seemed the basis for a proposal of marriage, though. As Mr. Weems laid out the matter, it became a little clearer. Jamie had promised Lizzie a dowry, consisting of a section of prime land, and Mr. Weems, freed from his indenture, had a freeman's homestead claim of 50 acres as well, to which Lizzie was heir. The Weems land adjoined the McGilvery's section, and the two together would make a very respectable farm. Evidently, with her three girls now married or suitably engaged, Manfred's marriage was the next step in Uta McGilvery's master plan. Reviewing all of the available girls within a 20-mile radius of the ridge, she had settled upon Lizzie as the best prospect and sent Robin round to open negotiations.
"Well, the McGilvery's are a decent family," Jamie said judiciously.
He dipped a finger into my bowl of bloodroot shavings and dotted it thoughtfully on his blotter, leaving a chain of red fingerprints.
"They've not much land, but Robin does well enough for himself, and we Manfreds are hard worker, from all I hear."
Robin was a gunsmith, with a small shop in Cross Creek. Manfred had been apprenticed to another gunmaker in Hillsborough, but was now a journeyman himself. "Would he take her to live in Hillsborough?" I asked. That might weigh heavily with Joseph Weems. While he would do anything to ensure his daughter's future, he loved Lizzie dearly, and I knew that the loss of her would strike him to the heart. He shook his head. His hair had dried and was beginning to rise in its usual fair wisps.
"Robin says not. He says the lad plans to ply his trade in Woolham's Creek, providing he can manage a wee shop. They'd live at the farm."
He darted a sideways glance at Jamie, then looked away, blood rising under his fair skin. Jamie bent his head, and I saw the corner of his mouth tuck in.
So this was where he entered the negotiation, then.
Woolham's Creek was a small but growing settlement at the base of Fraser's Ridge. While the Woolhams, a local Quaker family, owned the mill there and the land on the far side of the creek, Jamie owned all of the land on the ridge side. He had so far provided land, tools and supplies to Ronnie Sinclair, Theo Fry and Bob O'Neill for the building of a cooper's shop, a smithy, still under construction, and a small general store, all on terms that provided us with an eventual share of any profit, but no immediate income. If Jamie and I had plans for the future, so did Uta McGilvery. She knew, of course, that Lizzie and her father held a place of special esteem with Jamie, and that he would, in all likelihood, be moved to do what he could for her. And that, of course, was what Joseph Weems was very delicately asking now. Might Jamie provide premises for Manfred at Woolham's Creek as part of the agreement? Jamie glanced at me out of the corner of his eye. I lifted one shoulder in the faintest of shrugs, wondering whether Lizzie's physical delicacy had entered into Uta McGilvery's calculations. There were a good many girls sturdier than Lizzie, and better prospects for motherhood. Still, if Lizzie should die in childbirth, then the McGilvery's would be the richer both for her dower land and the Woolham's Creek property. And new wives were not so difficult to come by.
"I expect something might be done," Jamie said cautiously.
I saw his gaze drift to the open ledger with its depressing columns of figures, then speculatively to me. Land was not a problem. With no cash and precious little credit, tools and materials would be. I firmed my lips and returned his stare. No, he wasn't getting his hands on my honey. He sighed and sat back, tapping his red-tinged fingers lightly on the blotter.
"I'll manage," he said. "What does the lass say, then? Will she have Manfred?"
Mr. Weems looked faintly dubious.
"She says she will. He's a nice enough lad, though his mother... Oh, a fine woman," he added hurriedly. "Very fine. If just a trifle... But..."
He turned to me, narrow forehead furrowed.
"I'm not sure Elizabeth knows her mind, ma'am, to say truly. She kens it would be a good match, and that it would keep her near me."
His expression softened at the thought, then firmed again.
"But I wouldna have her make the match only because she thinks I favour it."
He glanced shyly at Jamie, then at me.
"I did love her mother so," he said,
the words coming out in a rush as though confessing some shameful secret. He blushed bright pink and looked down at the thin hands he had twisted together in his lap.
"I see,"
I said, tactfully averting my own gaze and brushing a few bits of stray bloodroot off the desk.
"Would you like me to talk to her?"
"Oh, I should be most grateful, ma'am."
Lightened by relief, he nearly sprang to his feet. He wrung Jamie's hand fervently, bowed repeatedly to me, and at last made his way out with much bobbing and murmuring of thanks. The door closed behind him, and Jamie sighed, shaking his head.
"Christ knows it's trouble enough to get daughters married when they do ken their own minds," he said darkly, plainly thinking of Brianna and Massali. "Maybe it's easier if they don't."
The single candle was guttering, casting flickering shadows over the room. I got up and went to the shelf where a few fresh ones lay. To my surprise, Jamie got up and came to join me. He reached past the assortment of half-burned tapers and fresh candles, pulling out the squat clock candle that sat behind them, hidden in the shadows. He set it on the desk and used one of the tapers to light it. The wick was already blackened. The candle had been used before, though it wasn't burned down very far. He looked at me, and I went quietly to shut the door.
"Do you think it's time?"
I asked softly, moving back to stand beside him. He shook his head, but didn't answer. He sat back a little in his chair, hands folded in his lap, watching the flame of the clock candle take hold and swell into a wavering light. Jamie sighed and put out a hand to turn his account book toward me.